From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Did you see last year's hit film Swiss Army Man? It starred Daniel Radcliffe and Paul Dano.
She sits alone just like every other day and looks out the window lost in her thoughts. You know that look. She's just as alone as you are.
But she doesn't have to be. You could talk to her.
Tell her you'd love to sit next to her today and every other day because life is short and no one deserves to ride the bus alone.
I want this to stop.
It's not working?
No.
We'll talk to the musical duo behind the score of Swiss Army Man. That's later this hour. First, though, we want to know, what are your favorite film scores? Star Wars, maybe? Inception? Give us a call and let us know. It's 404-500-9457. You can also post tunes to our Facebook page and our Twitter feed. We're at OST Talk. And remember, we might feature your comments or musical picks on the show. Earlier this year, Governor Nathan Deal signed a campus carry measure into law that effectively permits firearms on all public college campuses in Georgia. So there's a key question. Do guns make students safer? We discussed this with Matthew Bodie. He's a professor of English at the University of North Georgia and published a study on this issue. And Mark Rosenberg joined us as well. He's former president and CEO of the Task Force for Global Health. I first asked Matthew Bodie about his latest research.
Well, I asked through public records law to the two major universities in Utah, Utah State and University of Utah, for any instance of any person reporting to police that they had stopped a crime in progress against themselves or others using a gun. And as you know, Utah has had campus carry for more than a decade now, and the police reported back zero incidents of anyone reporting to them that they had used a gun to stop a crime. That was pretty surprising to me, even though the campus carry has been around for such a long time.
Mark, we don't have a huge, as far as I could find, a huge amount of information on about guns on campus. But we do have a lot of information about whether guns in a home makes the home safer or not, right?
We certainly have that. And let me say to start with, in service of full disclosure, that I'm a member of the NRA. And I believe that the right to own guns by law-abiding citizens is a right that's protected by the Constitution, and that's the law of the land. But I don't think that comes into conflict with protecting our students and protecting people and reducing gun violence. We can do both. But I think it comes down to two questions to look at the big picture. One is safety, and one is effectiveness. You asked what we know about the risk of guns in the homes. For a long time, people said that if you want to protect your family, you should have a gun in your home. Study after study, however, has shown that if you have a gun in your home, the risk of someone in your family being shot goes up 200%. It triples. It doesn't protect you. It puts you at much, much greater risk, and a risk of 200% is a huge, huge risk. We stop drugs from coming on the market if the risk of suicide, if the risk of side effects is 20%, we'll stop it. And the risk of suicide, if you have a gun in your house, goes up fivefold or 400%. So we know that having a gun in the home is a huge risk. But the real question, I think, in terms of this campus carry bill are two. The first is, what do we know about safety? And the second is, what do we know about the effectiveness of guns on campus?
Right. And Matthew, one of the main arguments, the reason why I assume that you conducted the study the way that you did, is one of the main arguments was that students and faculty might need to carry their firearms in order to prevent crime. Correct?
Yeah, there's been talk in the Georgia House, as you mentioned before, just as a rampant crime wave on campus, and that's just not accurate. So they've been saying people need to protect themselves if the need arises. And I asked Utah, people are exercising their right to protect themselves, and they don't see the need for that. They haven't reported to police that they need to do that. So, yeah, I'm looking at the assumption on the other side that there's some more lots of crime that we need to protect ourselves from.
Why the comparison? Why those two states, Utah and Colorado?
Well, those are two states that are held up as holy grails of the campus carry movement because they've had it, and I don't know if it's the longest, Utah obviously pretty long, but both of those have had it for a long time, and they always point to them as saying there's been no problems with those two states, especially during the Texas debate last year. They pointed to those two states as saying, here, look, it's happening, it's going well. And I'm like, it isn't happening at all. No one's using it. It isn't needed.
Mark, for whatever reason, we don't seem to have a lot of research. Bills that we often see introduced in legislatures, not just in Georgia, but at the federal level and in other states, don't always have evidence to back them up. Why is that?
The research on gun violence prevention was really stopped in the 1990s by a concerted campaign by the NRA. CDC had started to look at using science to help us understand the risks and benefits of gun carriage and gun possession. But that research, as important as it was just stopped in its tracks. The NRA also succeeded in stopping the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms from collecting information about guns. So we really know very, very little about what works. But there is some new information about the effectiveness of guns on campus and the effectiveness of guns to prevent mass shootings. And what that shows is that right-to-carry laws do not decrease mass shootings or the average number of people shot in these incidents. And second, the overwhelming majority of mass shootings occur in places where guns are allowed. This puts to rest the argument that if you don't allow guns on campus, campus will become a target for people who want to bring guns on and commit a mass shooting. Most of these occur not in sanctuaries, not where guns are not allowed, but most occur where guns are allowed. And finally, there's evidence that when mass shootings do start, armed civilians are not effective in stopping them. So the arguments that having guns on campus will make the campus more safe don't hold up at all. There's evidence against all of those benefits.
And yet, Matthew, we have a tweet from Ted Barfield that looks at it the other way. He says, Utah has had campus carry for a decade. Has there been mass carnage and loss of life? Let me address that to you to answer him, because it sounds like he's saying, well, if you have the right, you should have the right to carry your gun wherever you want to, and it doesn't appear to have hurt anyone in Utah.
The assumption is faulty, right, that there's been no mass shootings because we've allowed guns. No, there's been no mass shootings because the research that your other guest just mentioned, and also our police are doing a great job at doing proactive policing and not reactive policing. The link that they're trying to make with that tweet just doesn't hold up, that something hasn't happened and therefore we can take it back to one cause. I just don't think that is good reasoning.
And if I could add to what Matthew said, the real risks of having guns on campus are not mass shootings, but the real risk comes from things like violence, interpersonal violence or vendettas people have against other people. They come from suicide attempts. They come from alcohol abuse and risky behaviors that young people get involved in. And when you have guns around, these things, the violence, the suicide attempts, the drinking, the risky behaviors, turn from non-fatal to fatal. The real risk is that people will be hurt, killed, threatened, and really damaged by guns on campus. It's not safe, let alone ineffective.
Matthew, I want to play a comment for you that was made by Republican House Representative Mandy Ballinger, who was a sponsor of the year's bill. That she made this comment right after the measure passed the House.
In working as a victim advocate, it's really the God-given right that people have to not be a victim. States that have enacted campus carry or campus safety have become safer. The numbers prove that, and so we just want to afford that protection to all Georgians.
What do you have any idea what numbers she is referring to that prove that?
I don't, and she makes that comment a lot. She made it in her speech to the House, and she says, you know, I have 4 studies over here I can show you. And I back to the point of your other guest, the limited amount of research on gun and campus safety or just safety in general points to an issue that we need to address. And I think that, yes, she could probably point to one or two other studies, mainly by John Lott, that's been discredited. But the majority, it seems, of the limited amount we have, it just doesn't say that. And I don't think that there is a way in which to convince the representative otherwise.
That work that Matthew mentioned about right to carry laws, mm-hmm. research that was done by John Lott, he suggested that where you have right to carry laws, there are fewer violent crimes committed. But
that's still cited, that research.
That research is cited, but it is flawed. And many studies have shown that it's deeply flawed. And in fact, where you have right to carry laws, there's more gun violence, not fewer incidents, but more gun violence where you have right to carry laws.
Mark Rosenberg is former president and CEO of the Task Force for Global Health. And also we spoke with Matthew Bodie, professor of English at the University of North Georgia. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks,
Celeste.
Last week, six Georgia professors sued the state to overturn the campus carry law. They filed a joint complaint which said, quote, "Historically, the Board of Regents and university system institutions have taken the position that the free exchange of ideas is significantly curtailed if students or faculty are, or even feel, physically unsafe, and they have accordingly prioritized campus safety," end quote. Attorney Simon Bloom, partner at the Bloom Sugarman Law Firm, has been following this issue closely, and he brings us this commentary.
The so-called campus carry bill was signed into law by Governor Nathan Deal, allowing permit holders to carry concealed handguns on property owned by public colleges and universities, with several very broad exceptions. Nonetheless, a group of six professors in the university system recently sued Governor Deal and Attorney General Chris Carr to overturn the law. The lawsuit asked the court to declare the law unconstitutional and to enjoin its enforcement. The plaintiffs face a number of obstacles. First, the plaintiffs' reading of the Georgia Constitution is that the Board of Regents has complete authority over all aspects of campus life, regardless what the legislator says or does. The text, however, does not go that far. The court will probably find that while the Constitution certainly empowers the board to set policy for and govern its colleges as it sees fit, the Constitution does not prevent the legislature from passing laws of general application that trump existing board policy. Second, the plaintiffs will certainly face a challenge that they lack standing because they have not been injured by campus carry. To challenge the constitutionality of a statute, a plaintiff must show that the statute has an adverse impact on her rights. Plaintiffs allege that they are worried that the potential presence of concealed handguns in their classrooms will chill debates and create the potential for distressed students either to use or threaten to use their weapons to intimidate others. Courts cannot judge the constitutionality of a law in a particular case based on speculation and conjecture about potential harms the law may or may not cause in the future. Plaintiffs will be better served by pursuing a political solution through lobbying the legislature and governor to repeal campus carry and to follow the policy position that plaintiffs prefer.
That was attorney Simon Bloom with the Bloom Sugarman Law Firm. If you have thoughts on campus carry, give us a call and leave a message. It's 404-500-9457. You can also post to Twitter or Facebook, and remember, we might use your comments on the show. Just ahead, why do Georgia's politicians keep their seats no matter what they do? First, though, we talk with the Atlanta band that does it all, Manchester Orchestra. This is On Second Thought. I've got friends in all the right places. I know what they want, and I know they don't want me to stay. It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. The Atlanta band Manchester Orchestra is big time. Musicians Andy Hall and Robert McDowell scored the 2016 cult film Swiss Army Man with Daniel Radcliffe and Paul Dano, and they regularly play big festivals like Bonnaroo, Lollapalooza, and Shaky Knees. The band's been going strong since 2004 and just released their fifth studio album, A Black Mile to the Surface. This summer, I spoke with the guys behind Manchester Orchestra, Andy Hall and Robert McDowell. So what do you think, if you look back at the beginnings when you first got into the group, name a song for me in the album that's like the farthest away from where you were.
Mm-hmm. On the new album?
Yeah.
On the new album from where we were then?
Yeah.
I would say,
what's the biggest journey?
I think a song like The Alien, where we're now able to have complex parts but contain them and not have to rely on dynamics and angst and
volume
to relay the emotion. We've learned how to strip away and approach with the less is more, but still hopefully achieve the same emotions.
Mm-hmm. Made a pact with you and God. If you don't move, I swear to you, I'm gonna make you. Do you need
So you guys have stayed with indie labels. Why?
Somewhat, yeah. Well, I mean, the first label that we started our first label, I started it back when we released our very first EP in like 2005. And so we did a deal with Columbia Records underneath Sony that they would sort of buy or lease our record label and give us a budget to help release other records as well. But we still had a major label machine at our disposal to use certain aspects of it. We were always very weary of it at the beginning because all we'd heard were horror stories about bands signing too big a deals and then labels leaving them. And so we tried to be conscious and smart about what deals we were making. So we've really more found a way to hold on to the DIY mentality and the indie mentality, but we've also been able to partner with people who get that and have been able to give us, you know, a lot of great opportunities.
And Robert, what do you think that does for you to sort of steer away from the I guess music making machine that is, say, Columbia?
Well, I think the faster you rise, the faster you fall. And we're a band that we want to have 5 records, 10 records, 15 records, and
well, you have 5.
Yeah. Halfway there.
Yeah.
And I think when you partner with the right partner and they know that you're not looking for the biggest single in the world, you're looking for the best piece of art you can make right now, they let you control it more. And it gives you creative control to make the record you want to make instead of the record that's going to be the biggest success in this small window.
So let's talk a little bit about scoring a movie. And first, let's hear the finale song from the soundtrack of the 2016 film Swiss Army Man. What is the difference in music making and songwriting for you between making something for an album and making something for a film?
Well, an obvious difference for this particular score that we did was that we weren't allowed to use, for about 95% of the score, we weren't allowed to use any instruments. So it was all just my voice or the actor's voices or Robert's voice. So that was kind of like taking a, you know, not wanting to go to school, like I said before, but that was truly like a master's thesis of relearning how to make music and relearning how new ways to create atmosphere. And that's something that was heavily influential for us on this new album, because we had to learn how to make music without words that conveyed an emotional kind of hit you in the heart feeling. And we also had to do it in the span of, in some instances, 15 to 30 seconds. So how do you make a heartbreaking song in 15 seconds? And the score sort of taught us through over a 13-month headbanging on the wall experience how to do that and how to create these sort of sonic landscapes that we weren't really that focused on in previous Manchester records.
And it was nice creating something that isn't the main art piece. You're adding to someone else's vision. And I would say for our pride, that kind of like checks you a little bit. So going into this album, we were very open to like, well, yeah, like bring that to the table. We weren't so gung-ho on being the alpha male in the room. It was a lot warmer.
Mm-hmm.
So let's hear another clip from that film. This is called Talk to Her.
Oh,
shades of the Beach Boys there.
Sure.
And we can sort of hear your problem solving and how you got around not using instruments. But I wonder if you could ever see yourself, you know, you see, look at somebody like Danny Elfman, who said, all right, as soon as I started scoring movies, that was it. I was done with pop music. Hmm. Did you feel a sort of pull to do this again?
I think it more so influenced how we look at everything now. And for this Manchester record to really try and create an album within an album of sonic landscapes. And we wanted the album to sort of seem like a house where every different song is a room that you're in, and it's this different feeling. And we learned a ton of that from the score. It was very hard to do. I mean, it took us 13 months from start to finish to work on the score, so it wasn't something that we were like signing up for immediately. It would have to be something that we really believed in and cared about enough to put our hearts and brains into it for that long again.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with two of the members of Manchester Orchestra, Andy Hall and Robert McDowell. Then you just mentioned the new album, so let's hear another clip off the new album. This is called The Gold.
Ceiling. I don't think I love you anymore. That gold mine changed you. You don't have to hold me anymore. Our cave's collapsing. I don't want to be me anymore.
So one of the great things about you guys is you sound just as good live as you do on your album. Like, nobody's going to hear your music in the album and then go to the concert and be disappointed. That pleases me as a musician.
Yeah.
But there are other people for whom that's, you know, that's not a big deal, right? I mean, like, for other people, the craft of sort of engineering the perfect sound is the most important thing. And I wonder where you fall on that spectrum, whether it matters to you if a band or a singer can go and reproduce the same thing live.
I don't look down on somebody who can't pull off what's going on the album.
Because we've made records like that. Like, we obviously couldn't pull off the Swiss Army Man score. We've made solo records that there isn't a band.
Yeah, because you're layering your voice. But that's not exactly what I'm talking about, right? I'm talking about someone who needs an engineer to clean up the sound, to clean up the vocals. And
you know, if that person is a creative mind, you know, like somebody just totally outside of the box, what we're talking about, somebody like Kanye West, for example, is not a good singer, but has used technology and a ton of, you know, cool creative ways to make himself a good singer, I think that's amazing. I think there aren't any rules to creating music, and there shouldn't be any rules to creating amazing music. And if that means you have to put it through 100 different computers, as long as it sounds dope at the end of it, then you're in a good spot, you know? And I think technology now allows people to do that live and to recreate things like that with auto-tune, etc. For us, I think this just kind of goes back to our DIY roots and spending hundreds of days on the road for several years, the early part of our career. I don't know. I guess I just feel fortunate that we can sing and we can sing live. Because if we couldn't, I'm sure I would be using all the other tricks.
Okay, let's hear a little more music. This is an older tune, actually. This is not from the new album. This one is called Shake It Out. It's from Mean Everything Did Nothing.
Shake it out, shake it out. Gotta need another round, another round, another round, another. I can feel it now. I felt alone in my father's house. And I can see. Standing when we were 17. Make it clean. Are you the living ghost? What I need. Are you gonna get the best of me? We will see.
Do you think we can hear Georgia in your music?
There's definitely some Georgia, but I don't know if it's the same like Southern rock that you would classify.
Like the Allman Brothers.
Yeah.
Surely. I mean, certainly there's, you know, it might be more, you know, Neil Young, which isn't Southern rock, but it's still, there's definitely that there, this sort of swamp Southern Gothic thing that we like to dive into from time to time. I think it depends on the record that you're listening to, because all of our records sound a whole lot different from each other. So I think like on our third record, there was definitely more of a Southern, you know, element to it, where our fourth record probably not so much.
So, well, then let's hear from the third album. The third album was Simple Math, right?
Yes.
Okay, so this is actually the title track off that album. Easily one of the best lines. What if I was wrong and nobody cared to mention? So great. So then how do you stay together? Because it doesn't matter when we're what era we're talking mm-hmm. about. It is hard, especially when you're touring and mm-hmm. you're stuck in close quarters for yeah. long periods of time. That is hard. How do you make it work?
Well, I'm fortunate because Robert's my best friend, also is my brother-in-law, so he's sort of trapped in this relationship with me.
Right, you can't totally be mean to him or your sister's going to come down.
Well, sure.
But I also think we have a understanding in a relationship where we do bicker a lot because we don't have time to navigate feelings, especially in the studio where what I'm saying is harsh and would hurt my wife's feelings. I don't care if they hurt his feelings right. because it's for the greater good, and, well, and same you, if it comes like towards
you,
me.
We can't have feelings during that process. It's like you got to kind of throw out your personal, side of if this idea is good or if this idea is not. And ultimately, I think the thing that keeps it together is having a group of people, and especially with Robert and Tim and Andy. Everyone's dedicated to the same thing. We want to make the best possible record that we can.
So let's listen to one more song from the new album. That this track is The Sunshine. I already know that I don't already know. You are sunlight. I don't really care if you don't understand. You are moonlight. And that's all I. What do you like about this album?
I like it because nothing was left untouched. And sometimes we added too much stuff and we would have to strip it away. Sometimes we wouldn't add enough stuff. But I know that everything on this record is intentional. And there's not really anything that I see myself looking back on being like, I wish I would have done that different, because with everything we tried it differently and we're committed that that's the best thing we can do. It's the best album we can make, so I'm very, very proud of that.
Yeah, I'm just proud that we stuck with it. You know, it was a 6-month process, and you know, there was a mental breakdown at 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, 4 months, and we always rallied and said, all right, I'm getting up tomorrow. I'm going to continue down our voyage of trying to find the next cool keyboard sound and, you know, try not to kill ourselves in the process. And when you finally reached that point where we had a rule, you know, for we wouldn't be happy with a song until we were jumping up and down. And like, that's how we knew we would love the song. And it took like 3 months for us to get that on one song. And when we finally got it, it was like, all right, well, we know it's possible. We just have to do it 10 more times. And then putting the work in and making that happen and actually jumping up and down for 11 songs and realizing this record is what we had, as close as to what we dreamed as it could be. There's just a sense of joy and satisfaction with that. And now it's like, you know, you let it go and it's, you let people have it now.
You know, the process that you're describing is not what a lot of teenagers think of when they think that they're going to be in a successful band, right?
Correct.
They do not think of it as being mean to each other because it's about business and it's not personal. They don't think about getting up early in the morning and slaving away and being slightly OCD about all yeah. the details, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So what advice would you give to
Run!
Get into it for the right reason, because unless you really love making music and being a musician,
it's not worth it.
There's not enough money or fame to balance it out.
Yeah.
So you got to do it for the art.
Yeah, if you can find, if that's your happy place, is pushing yourself to be creative and to try new things and realize that it's going to be hard forever. And like every record we put out, it just gets harder and harder to try and find something that is original and interesting and inspiring for us, much less thinking about what listeners would want to hear. But if that's something you really love and it makes you feel all weird and fuzzy inside, then do it.
That's Andy Hull and Robert McDowell. They're half of the Atlanta band Manchester Orchestra. The new album is A Black Mile to the Surface, and they'll perform at the Tabernacle in Atlanta this Saturday at 7 p.m. We'll go out on their new song, The Moth. Just ahead, the Georgia House of Representatives had the highest rate of uncontested seats last year. How do they do that? This is On Second Thought. The last thing that you heard was in. I'm Celeste Headlee. It's On Second Thought. Earlier this week, the Atlanta City Council voted yes to a measure to decriminalize marijuana. Now, those with caught with an ounce or less will pay a small fine instead of serving jail time or getting a criminal record. We'll talk about this on tomorrow's show, and we want you to chime in here. Is the decriminalization of weed a good move or not? Call us at 404-500-9457 and leave a message or post to social media. And then be sure to join us for that conversation tomorrow at 9. In the 2016 election cycle, the Georgia House had the highest rate of uncontested seats of any state house in the country. Of 180 House seats, only 31 had candidates from both parties. The uncontested seats amounted to roughly 83%. I talked about this with Greg Bluestein, political reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and also Andra Gillespie, political science professor at Emory University.
Hello.
Okay, so Greg, why don't many of these seats have, why don't the parties even try to field a candidate?
Yeah, it's a strange but familiar paradox. I mean, at the same time, there's this anti-incumbent wave, it seems like every cycle. The vast majority of incumbents get reelected, even if they have stunning problems like some of our incumbents did.
Well, let me mention one of those. Here is Georgia House. Here's Representative Tommy Benton, who faced a great deal of criticism for publicly defending the KKK.
And I understand that African Americans, for the most part, have a problem with the slavery issue, but they don't denounce their ancestors that were in Africa that were selling slaves. They find it offensive because they have not been taught a true history of the war.
Okay, we're not going to go into that. I can see Andra
wants to.
Yes, but this is one of those people, I think it's fair to say, a troubling history, still reelected.
Mm-hmm. And there was incumbents with arrests. There's incumbents with lawsuits, damaging lawsuits against them. There was all sorts of, you know, red flags at some incumbents, and yet they all were elected. Well, most of the incumbents were elected with sizable majorities. It speaks about the burden, the high barrier of entry, I think is the right way to say it, to running for election. It costs.
Are you talking about money?
Yeah, it costs a lot of money. It takes a lot of time, especially if you're outside of Metro Atlanta. It means risking your personal business. It means taking a toll on your family life. I helped moderate a panel the other day of young lawmakers, and there was a lot of wannabe candidates in the room, and it ended up being a long discussion from those young lawmakers about the toll that running for office takes on their life. And these were mostly Metro Atlanta politicians, but it's not just a 40-day legislative session anymore. It's an almost year-round affair, and if you don't have employment that in a boss or a personal business that where you can take
walk
the time
away,
off you need,
yeah.
It's really hard to do it these days. And these races are so expensive now.
Well, Andra, to what extent, let's hear a little clip of John Oliver giving a theory. His is his theory about why some legislators mm-hmm. keep their seats.
State houses do a huge amount of work while no one is watching, from abortion to gun control to environmental legislation. And yet, admit it, you probably don't know who your state legislator is, which means all those conspiracy theories about a shadow government are actually true.
Okay, so to what extent is this just a reflection of how ill-informed, uninformed we all are on our state government and how little we value that.
Well, I mean, I think it's probably a combination of all of those things. So when we think about, in general, why incumbency advantage works, there are a lot of things. So some of the more obvious reasons are because somebody has high name recognition, people will see their name on a ballot, and if that's the one that they know, like even if they don't know much about that person, they know, I actually have heard of this person before where I haven't heard of the other candidates on the ballot. So that's going to give them an advantage. There's certainly an advantage with incumbency that allows people to have access to greater fundraising networks and other types of things. But the other thing that people talk about in political science is this notion of people vote what they know. And so even if what they know is bad, you are voting what you know versus the unknown. So people can make all kinds of empty promises that aren't based in any type of experience base. So especially if you have a candidate who hasn't held office before, making promises about all of the things that they're going to do running up against an experienced candidate, you may not like everything about the experienced incumbent, but they at least have a track record. And so the track record is safer than the unknown.
That's exactly the opposite of what happened in the presidential election.
Well,
right?
No, I mean, so in this particular case, while they're both very known commodities, and while Hillary Clinton had experience, neither of them had experience being president. So, you know, if it had been Donald Trump versus Barack Obama, Barack Obama's incumbency advantage may have helped him to some degree. I mean, there's a racial element that we wouldn't talk about, but this is all kind of counterfactual there. But it's the reason why most good candidates wait for an open seat. They don't like to run against incumbents.
Okay, so let's talk about redistricting and how that plays into this. Here's Roland Martin, a commentator on News One Now at this point. He's explaining a controversial measure from the last session of the legislature here in Georgia that might help explain what we're talking about.
Speaking of elections in Georgia, Republican majority state Senate is set to vote on a bill passed by the House that would redraw 9 of their districts in an effort to protect their majority. The changes would reduce the number of people of color in districts where these Democratic leaning voters have threatened to oust Republican incumbents.
Now, Greg, your reporting today seems to suggest that maybe Republican Alan Peake agrees with this to a certain extent. He suggests in the article that you posted that uncontested seats and the redistricting actually leads to greater polarization.
Yeah, if you know you're in a safe seat, if you know you have no real challenge out there, then what's the incentive for working across party lines? That's his point, and that's a broader point that's being made all over the nation with groups that are trying to push for more nonpartisan levels of redistricting, and yet those efforts languish. And there was a group that just earlier this year, a bipartisan group, mostly Democrats, but Josh McCoon, Republican senator, was also part of that coalition, that pushed for a citizens commission to help redraw the district lines, and it went nowhere. Didn't even get a vote.
So one of the things that I'll point out is that when we try to identify the cause of polarization in the United States, there's a lot of contestation, you know, amongst political scientists about what causes polarization. So the argument in favor of districting causing polarization is based on newer data that is still being vetted, and people are still kind of arguing about it. The older literature, which has been published, suggests that it's really not districting that's the issue, that it's more our own ideological polarization. So in fact, American citizens themselves are becoming more polarized. And so you don't have as many liberal Republicans or conservative Democrats anymore being a moderating force within their own party. So if people are going to, you know, the camps are becoming more extreme and therefore are disincentivized from working with one another.
So Todd Rehm has some comments for you, Greg. He says, first, he tweets, "My dad lives in Representative Benton's district. No one there has heard the Atlanta-based criticism of him." That's point number one. And number two, Todd asks, if it's about the cost of running, why so many Democratic candidates in 7, which takes millions, and none for the Gwinnett Commission?
That's a good point. But you are seeing right now already there, Stacey Abrams, who's running for governor, of course, she represents an in-town Atlanta district. There are already 3 candidates running for that seat, and they've raised, I think, more than $150,000 between the 3 of them. It might be close to $200,000. That talks about the cost of running for even an open seat that's a safe Democratic seat. If you look at the 180 state House seats that are up for grabs next year, there might be 10 to 15 that are going to be truly competitive. And that might be a stretch, even saying 10 to 15 are truly competitive. There's a handful of districts that are held by Republicans that Hillary Clinton won in November. Those are the ones that that Democrats will have an eye on. But still, it speaks to the vast majority of these House districts and Senate districts, state Senate districts, too, are just not competitive at all between the two parties.
So if I could, hey, Todd, by the way, if I could respond to that, I mean, part of this issue is party building and capacity. So where you have in general elections people running unopposed, that suggests that the other party might not have the capacity or needs to build capacity to be able to mount strong challengers so that these districts...
They don't have the capacity to create capacity.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, if you're not contesting seats, then what that suggests is that there's some party building that needs to happen so that you are cultivating strong candidates to run. Because even in some of these, you know, overwhelmingly Democratic and overwhelmingly Republican districts, there is a minority, and it's actually in some ways probably sizable minority of people who represent the other point of view who would actually at least want to have a contest about what's going on. Now, most candidates would look at that, and if you know the district is 70-30 and you represent the 30%, you're not going to waste your time because you don't want to cultivate a reputation of being kind of the crackpot candidate who always runs and never wins for office. So that actually keeps candidates out of it. But if the parties were developing in the places where they were uncompetitive so that you would have more competitive races, that would be fine. But I think the other issue, the Tommy Benton issue, is what happens, you know, internally within Republican Party politics in his district. So is there somebody who's willing to run and challenge them? And I think the thing that we're worried about in this day and age is not necessarily being challenged by the center. It's being challenged by somebody who's actually more extreme.
Todd Rehm is still tweeting. I won't read them all, but it's clear he wanted to be part of this discussion. But Greg Bluestein, to what extent is this just a function of the fact that people are just voting on party lines? I mean, in that case, it doesn't have anything to do necessarily with redistricting or money or anything else, just that if you're a member of the Republican Party, you're going to vote for whomever the Republican is.
Yeah, and that's the key point of this next cycle. Andra spoke about it. The biggest challenges these candidates often face is from their own party, their own flanks.
Yeah,
that was the big question that dominated the 2016 elections, whether or not Republicans who voted in favor of the transportation tax increases would end up getting punished for it. They didn't. And many of them faced primary challengers who tried to exploit that fact. But still, there will be the same thing in 2018. There'll be challengers from within their own parties who will try to pounce on candidates for their votes rather than candidates from opposing parties who try to do the same thing.
We have about 30 seconds, Andra. You want to tell us what might change this?
So, since we're still arguing in academic circles about whether it's ideological polarization or districting, I think we need to separate the empirics from the normative issue. And I think we need to ask ourselves an ethical question. Should we allow partisans and elected officials to draw their own district lines? Something is really problematic about that just from a theoretical standpoint. So can we do nonpartisan districting?
That's Andra Gillespie, political science professor at Emory University, and Greg Bluestein is reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Did you know GPB records live sessions with bands in our performance studio? It's a project called GPB Music Presents, launched by Grant Blankenship and Trevor Young. Earlier this year, we taped the band Funk You from Augusta. Take a listen. We'll be right back.
search for them all around. Only I am here. Lay your car
was the band Funk You from Augusta. They were jamming in GPB's performance studio. You can see them tonight at the Augusta Common at 7 p.m. And to catch more of our music video sessions, go to gpbnews.org and then hit the GPB Music Presents tab. That's our show for today, but we want to hear your opinion. We talked earlier this hour about campus carry on Georgia universities. Do you think guns on college campuses make students and faculty more or less safe? Give us a call, 404-500-9457. Leave a message there. Or post to Facebook and Twitter. We're at OST Talk, and I'm at Celeste Headley. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. Have a great day. Yes, if I could